Welcome to the Regulating AI podcast. We are live from the ITU AI for Good conference here in Geneva, Switzerland. I have a fantastic guest with me, Hovig, who is with the UN Refugee Agency. Hovig, welcome to the Regulating AI podcast.
Thank you for having me here.
Hovig, please tell our global listeners about the UN Refugee Agency and about your role there and how did you come to that position?
I've been now with the UNHCR, the UN Refugee Agency, for almost 20 years. We are the United Nations mandated agency for refugees. So our role is to ensure international protection for refugees. And also, we're one of the biggest humanitarian UN agencies in the world. I started this journey long ago. I've worked in many countries on the African continent and the Middle East, mostly with our humanitarian response. So building refugee camps, managing refugee camps, negotiating with host governments, working closely with refugee communities who we are paid to serve. Mm-hmm. So I've played many roles in UNHCR. My most recent role, before coming to Geneva, I was the head of Mosul office in Iraq during the war in 2016-2019, where we were supporting internally displaced Iraqis fleeing the war. And since mid-2019, I've been heading the innovation service for UNHCR. And our role in the innovation service is to help both refugees and UNHCR teams innovate. We collectively face very complex problems. And the role of our innovation service is to help refugees and our teams solve some of those complex problems.
Well, it will be a surprise to a lot of them, including me, that there is an innovation office within the refugee office of UN. So that is fantastic. What role does artificial intelligence, AI, play in this UN refugee office, Hovig?
Well, for us, AI is a disruptive technology.
Okay.
But for us, all technologies are a means to an end and not an end by itself. And so obviously with the advancements in AI, because we have been actually experimenting with AI for a number of years now, even before generative AI. Mm-hmm. But now obviously with generative AI, things have moved faster and solutions are now much more sophisticated. What we're using AI for is to improve services to refugees. That's one element of how we are using AI for good. Mm-hmm. So we work very closely with refugee communities in the analog world. Our added value as a UN organization mandated to support refugees is to be close to refugees. Wherever I've worked, we're the first ones who meet the refugee crossing the border. Mm-hmm. That proximity of the relationship allows us to better serve them. Mm-hmm. And over years, we started getting better at collecting the data, analyzing the data so that we can better serve them. Mm-hmm. Now we are using AI to optimize the analysis of that data so that we can, let's say, establish feedback mechanisms to hear their complaints or their suggestions at a faster pace to solve some of the challenges that they have at a faster pace than we did before. Mm-hmm. So we're definitely using AI to both improve our services to refugees, but also improve our understanding of refugees.
To improve the services to them as well as understand them. Hovig, the population of refugees worldwide has grown dramatically in the past few decades, and it just keeps growing on the number of displaced people around the world. Is AI a technology, when you look at chatbox and other things, that can really provide firstly, that ability for them, because now you can scale up dramatically with this technology, because with the numbers of refugees going up, obviously you can't just keep incrementally growing the staff because it requires funding. What kinds of tools and technologies are you using? Tell our listeners, I mean, I'm just thinking from their perspective, because you could be using agents, you could be using chatbots. Maybe I'm getting ahead of myself now, I'm getting excited. But tell our audience what you're using or not also could be down the pike, because that is a pretty exciting thing, because ultimately, how can we help the refugees?
Yes, and I think this is there's no straight answer into does this mean we lead less people? The answer is not necessarily.
Yes.
And I'll tell you why.
To deal with more people.
Yes, because what has happened over time is, you know, in the analog world, refugees would have to come to our offices.
Physically.
Line up.
Mm.
In the camp, it might be in refugee camp, it might be easier because it's in closer proximity.
Right.
But most refugees live in urban areas, not in camps. Mm. So for them to come to our office was difficult. Sometimes people have to walk for kilometers before reaching UNHCR. Mm. So over time, what did we do? We started call centers. This is even in the what we call the analog world.
Analog world.
Call centers have had improved our reach. So people would start calling us. Mm. Then we started upgrading our call centers. A few years ago, our innovation service tested third-party messaging apps like WhatsApp, for example, which is the preferred channel of communication for refugees globally. But by using their preferred channels of communication like WhatsApp in the digital space, what happened is that the volume of people reaching out to us has increased.
Mm.
So yes, the numbers are increasing, but us opening digital channels of communication has also increased the volume of demand. Now, a few years ago, we started testing chatbots. So that's another layer. Mm. But most people have individual complex cases. And so whereas chatbots could answer simple questions, we want the human in the loop.
Mm.
So you will end up, first of all, not discussing confidential information on third-party messaging apps. So yeah, so as I was saying, we, you know, after we established the call centers, we started using chatbots, which then allowed us to answer frequently asked questions. But then most people have an individual case, an individual grievance, an individual worry, something very particular about their case. And so you need a human in the loop. You need then a human to talk to them. We don't want to exchange with refugees on third-party messaging apps on very confidential issues. So we will establish other channels for us to talk to them, even including a family visit. We go to their place, etc. So that's another kind of area where things have grown. The number of people we're getting to know using digital spaces is very high. But you were mentioning also, when we're talking, many people have the drive to be connected. But it's not given in the last mile. So we have a Connectivity for Refugees program that is trying to help 20 million refugees connect to the grid by 2030. This is together with the ITU and GSMA.
Wow.
We need to solve problems like access to devices for refugees to be able to connect with us and with their families back home, but also with humanitarian actors so that we can improve our services. So that's the second layer, which is the chatbots. Mm. Now we are at a stage where we are using AI to identify bottlenecks in our service to them, process of feedback, so that we can solve those kind of problems. So we're getting better at transitioning from the analog services to the digital services, and AI is kind of speeding the process up.
What roadblocks do you see? Because this is where I feel, Hovig, that AI and technology is really, I mean, we can talk about all the other great things. This is where we are really impacting human lives here. What roadblocks do you see that are hindering what you would ultimately like you to do?
There's a few. Thank you for the question. One is, I was alluding to it, is the access of refugees to the grid.
Right.
So the more we have communities connected, the better we can serve them. So one big roadblock is the access to the digital in
this
the last mile.
Satellite
or other means of connectivity. But in the last mile, we have many refugees in remote areas in the world where connectivity hasn't reached.
Okay.
Devices are still too expensive. Refugees need connectivity not only to be in touch with the rest of the world, but it's also a means to solve their own challenges. We have launched, for example, a project on digital employment for refugees. Imagine refugees, Syrian refugees in Jordan, working for a Finnish company remotely. refugees have that commitment and they want to do this. There's this craving for education. But if you don't have connectivity, if you don't have laptops, you will miss out on the opportunity. So I think one element is the infrastructure. The more investment we have in the infrastructure where refugees live, we can speed up their digital access to it. There are also legal impediments. Sometimes refugees don't have even the right to own a SIM card. So we're working with governments also on legal rights, the right to open a bank account. There's a misconception about refugees. There's a lot of misconceptions. One of them is, you know, reliance of assistance. People don't want to rely on assistance. They want to lead a dignified life. But if you can't open a bank account, how can you work? So we also try to pacify those kind of legal barriers for refugees to have access to the digital world. We also have resourcing issues on the humanitarian side. Technologies cost money. And with dwindling resources, it's very difficult for organizations to invest if we don't have the resources. Hence the need for us to work with the private sector. We're working with many companies who are here at the AI for Good Summit because they have a role to play in equaling the playing field, working with us to reduce cost of access to technologies and solutions so that we can better serve refugees and displaced populations. There's also the idea of not parachuting technologies on people. We're very keen. We have a refugee-led innovation program that invests in refugee-led organizations innovating. So we give them both financial support and technical support for them to lead the innovation projects they want wherever they live. So we believe that communities have to be part and parcel of the design of AI solutions. Some of the challenges lie in institutions, entities, developing solutions elsewhere and trying to parachute those solutions or test those solutions on communities. We are not part of that club. We believe that the solutions need to be developed together with communities, ethically, respecting human rights values and principles, and making sure that the communities we serve are fully knowledgeable about the solutions we're developing.
So you said basically the grid being a challenge, a device. Sometimes they don't have device. In some cases, it's legal impediments because there is not clarity across the board on rules and laws. Can they open a bank account or not? And then obviously parachuting technologies from outside rather than going ground up. Is mobile payments and things of that nature playing a role in?
Absolutely.
It is?
Absolutely. And we are using digital currencies more and more. Mobile money is, wherever it's possible, is used by us and many other organizations. So I think we've gotten better at the mobile money component.
Okay.
But you're never perfect. We always improve the way we do our programming. So that definitely has goes far. But I think the answer to that is the financial inclusion of refugees wherever they live. The ultimate goal is for them to have the right to open a bank account, have access to jobs. Mobile money is a means to that end. It's a bridge towards that.
It's a bridge, yeah.
As we build the bridge, we need to also build the infrastructure on the other side so that eventually our cash distributions need to stop. They cannot continue forever. But what happens when you stop a cash distribution but refugees don't have access to jobs?
Yeah.
They again fall into very difficult situations. So I think whereas we are keen on our humanitarian response and our assistance, we are also keen on making sure that refugees have the resources and the capability to live a dignified life without humanitarian.
Live a dignified life. Is there an opportunity to reskill? Because AI is now hot and there are a lot of need for AI skills. I could be wrong. Generally, refugees tend to be of a younger populate demographic. So maybe their adaption for mobile, for AI would be better. And I know maybe that's not your office in terms of innovation, but giving some reskilling opportunities, Hovik?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And we are working on it, actually. Okay. We have launched what we call IDEA, which is the Inclusive Digital Economy Alliance, which is about refugees having access to the digital economy. What does that mean? It means infrastructure, so them having access to connectivity, laptops and whatnot, legal right to work, skilling and reskilling, job matching. I was in Rwanda not long ago, and I met with a group of young refugees. We had a digital employment project with them. Some of them already have their companies established.
Wow.
And what they need is contracts so that they can first make the company work and hire more refugees. So the demand from all of the refugee communities I've worked in Africa and Middle East, but also all the work we do in Latin America and Asia and even in Europe, the demand for skills is high. The zeal to work is very high. You know, I come from a refugee background. My grandparents were Armenian refugees in the Middle East. And I know how hardworking my grandparents' generation was because they were refugees and they had to, you know, life was difficult and they had to defeat those challenges. So the drive is there. The question is, does the rest of the world have the willingness to lend a hand to work with these communities? The potential for reskilling and upskilling is very high. As you said, very young populations, eager to learn languages. Mm-hmm. In many of the camps I've managed, we have language schools, we have IT skills sessions, etc. It's just that we need more investments in that domain and not only skilling. There's a lot of skilling and reskilling that happens. Many companies come and skill refugees. The question is not whether the skills, it's the jobs. Because if you skill, a few years ago, I was managing a camp in Jordan, Za'atari camp for Syrian refugees. At the time, coding was the fashionable thing. Now it's AI.
Coding's going away.
Yes. But at the time, coding was the fashionable thing.
Yep.
Many companies came to the camp I was managing and they would, all of them wanted to code. And I would say, great, but what next? Oh, well, we were just going to do the coding. What are they going to do after you teach them coding? Well, that's not our specialty. I think that's the problem. If you look at any challenge from a very myopic way, you just look at one element of the problem, it's very difficult to then achieve results. So skilling and reskilling is very important, but it has to be in a context that you're thinking about what next. And what next is what? Jobs. Access to the global digital economy. The more we give access to refugees to the global digital economy, pacify the hurdles, the easier the solutions would be. And then you would have more communities who are willing to be reskilled and upskilled. Because also people see when you have a portion of the population in the camp all received coding skills and then none of them are working. That's not also a good example.
Hovik, finally, I'm probably taking you in a direction your innovation office not, but you now got my mind flowing. Data labeling is a very big thing for artificial intelligence where, you know, the internet data gets labeled with certain tags and categories. A lot of that work has been done in Africa and other places, which is where, you know, the foundation companies and others are doing it because AI needs huge amounts of data that is makes sense. Is there an opportunity to do some kind of a public-private partnership with these organizations because they need help and they're looking for help for people with language skills, with expertise, those kinds of things? Does your organization do public-private partnerships?
We have an opinion about this. First, yes, we do, and we're very keen on public-private partnerships. So we know we can't do it alone.
Yes.
And as I said earlier, we work with many private sector companies. I think for us, what is very important is the refugees have access to all of the different ranges of skills and jobs that the global economy offers. What we don't want is refugees boxed into low-paying jobs that are also not necessarily respecting the dignified working environment and whatnot. So as long as it is within a global effort to bring opportunities to refugee communities across different layers of, let's say, data services or digital services, then we feel more comfortable. What we want to avoid is all of the pitfalls of, let's say, in the analog world, the sweatshops. We don't want to take that into the digital space. We want refugees to have dignified jobs as long as they have a potential for growth, as long as they are fairly paid, and fairly paid according to the local economy, obviously.
Yeah.
As long as the intention is towards that, we're very willing to work with partners. But we want to avoid the pitfalls of what we see in the global economy. We don't want refugees to just be a means to cut costs and box them into a certain workforce category.
Yeah, that makes sense. You don't want to box them in. You want to give them mobility up there, Hovig. I've learned a lot. Maybe, Hovig, we should stop calling them refugees. Maybe that's something to think about, because that's become a little bit of a perception issue. They are just talented people. But, Hovig, thank you so much for being on the Regulating AI podcast, and thanks for the great work you're doing for the displaced people, is what I call, at least I think of them, around the world, and how AI is transforming in some ways their lives.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you so much.
Cheers.